So what I was saying is this is the third and final math lecture. I'm going to take math part four and integrate it into the one-dimensional problem section. And I mentioned that we haven't talked about bra space and ket space formally, so I want to do that today. And the other important thing that we haven't talked very much about are eigenvalues and eigenvectors, so I want to talk about them today. So then I was reading this laundry list of all these different things that I'm going to talk about, but since I'm going to talk about them, I'm going to skip reading them again and just keep talking. So you've seen this overhead before. This was an overhead I showed you, which is talking about the geometry of quantum mechanics. And I said that quantum mechanics takes place in a Hilbert space, which for most of our purposes is going to be an infinite dimensional vector space. Certainly whenever position or momentum are involved, it's going to be infinite dimensional. There are cases where it's finite dimensional, and the examples that Shankar shows at the beginning are the finite dimensional examples because they're much easier to see what's going on. Okay. So this slide that I showed you earlier is actually postulate number one, which says that the state of the system is represented by a state vector in Hilbert space. So last time I told you what the postulates were. So this picture and what we said about this already is equivalent to the postulates. I then said that we also have operators. So if you have a state vector psi 1 and you take one of these operators, then it changes the state vector from this vector to a different vector. And so we're going to talk about operators. And the important thing about operators in terms of quantum mechanics is that the eigenvalues of the operators correspond to what you measure. So that's very strange. That's very different than classical physics. And this picture actually has two of the postulates in it. The first postulate is that physical observables are represented by Hermitian operators. Hermitian operators have real eigenvalues. Since we're going to measure something like the position, we don't want the position to be complex valued or imaginary valued. And so all of the observable operators have real eigenvalues. And this also has the third postulate built into it, which is that when you measure a physical observable, you'll get an eigenvalue of that operator. Okay. Now, I told you before that the dynamics of the system is given by the Hamiltonian, as described by the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And we talked a little bit about that, and we talked about the geometry of that, namely that the change in psi is given by the Hamiltonian times dt. So it's the Hamiltonian that generates time evolution of the system. And that's actually postulate four. Postulate four says the time evolution of the state vector is given by the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. So actually you saw all the postulates before, just I didn't tell you they were the postulates. Okay. I don't think I showed you this before. The vectors in the Hilbert space are abstract vectors, so just like the velocity is an abstract vector, it's only in coordinates after you choose a coordinate system. It's the same thing here. The state vector is an abstract vector. You can choose a basis, and if you choose a basis and represent the state vector in that basis, then that's a specific representation of it, but it's not the most general thing. The state vector in quantum mechanics contains in it all of the information about it, which means that you can take this abstract vector, and if you put in here the position basis, then you end up with the wave function in position space. If you put in here, instead of the position basis, the momentum basis, then you end up with the wave function in momentum space. And if you put in here the energy basis, then you end up with the wave function in energy space. Okay. So the inner product of psi with x is psi of x, and the inner product of psi with p is psi hat of p. Hat tells us that this function is it represents the same vector, but it looks different because it's a function of p. And if you take the inner product of psi with e, then that gives you psi twiddle of e, which is the energy space wave function. Now, this basis is very different than any basis you've thought about before, because this basis vector right here represents the value of the wave function at a point on the line. And this one represents at a different point on the line. And this one represents at a different point on the line. So we need an infinite basis for the position, because if we need the position over a finite interval that has an infinite number of points, or we need the position over an infinite interval or a semi-infinite interval, which also have an infinite number of points. So this composite here of the state vector psi and the energy, so the state vector ket and the energy bra, is an inner product. And this inner product, just like dot products, project the state vector onto the basis vectors. So that says the same thing. Okay. So the geometry of measurement looks like this. You have the state vector. When you measure something, then the state vector jumps to an eigenvector of the x operator. The eigenvector of the x operator, for example, this eigenvector of the x operator represents one point on the line. And it may jump to here, or it may jump to here. And this eigenvector represents another point on the line. So when it, after it makes its quantum jump, it has a projection along many, many of the x of these x directions, and that's how it turns out to be a continuous wave function. So this has the third, the third postulate built into it, namely that measurement of a physical observable will reside in an eigenvalue of the operator, and the state of the system will correspond to one of the eigenvectors of the measured operator. Okay? So when you measure the position, you get x, a number. That number is where you are on the line. And after you've measured, if you measure x to be at the point that corresponds to pi, then it will be along this eigenvector that corresponds to pi. Okay. So this x basis is an infinite dimensional basis, and it doesn't represent what you're used to in terms of the directions in space. It represents points on the line. Is it okay? Okay, so that's what I told you before. Now what I want to tell you about is is eigenvectors and eigenvalues. So first I want to tell you about the geometry of them. So we have eigenvalues and eigenvectors if it's a finite dimensional space. We have eigenvalues and eigenfunctions if we're talking about wave functions. And if we're talking about the Hilbert space, we have eigenvalues and we have eigenstates. We either have eigenbras or we have eigenkets. Okay? But all of these are exactly the same idea. And they're the answer to the question, when does an operator just stretch or shrink a vector without changing its direction? Or the other aspect of it is, when does an operator just change the phase of a vector? So here is a state vector psi, and here is an operator omega. Now, one thing that omega can do is it doesn't have to take this psi and move it into a different direction. It can just multiply it by a constant, and that constant can be a real number, or it can be a complex valued number. In general, that's not the case. In general, when you have an operator acting on a vector psi, it's not just some number times the vector psi. In general, it's a new vector. So it's not just a stretched or a shrunk vector. But for Hermitian operators, it stretches it. Okay. Now, why are these eigenvectors so important in quantum mechanics? It's because the time evolution is given by the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, which is this equation, which we talked a little bit about before. And this equation tells us that the evolution, that if you take the state vector and you resolve it into the energy basis, then the energy eigenvectors, when you act on them with the Hamiltonian, stay in the same direction. So whatever energy values you start out with, the system will stay in those energy values. It won't, in say, if you take the same vector, which has projections along all of the energy axes, which are varying only by a time-dependent phase factor, then that doesn't mean x will have no time evolution. It doesn't mean p will have no time evolution. It means that the Hamiltonian is a very special operator in quantum mechanics. It's the one in which the vectors stay stationary, which the vectors stay pointing in the same direction. So we say that the we say that the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian are called stationary states, and the time evolution is only in the phase. Okay. So now I brought the demonstration of this. So these are two pendulums, and they're set up so that if nobody's messed with them, they have the same period of oscillation. So now, if I take a spring, a weak spring, and I connect these two together, then we'll find that the states of the system now, the two pendulums are coupled by the spring. So now there are two states of motion. One of them is the one that we already had. If I do that, and I don't stretch the spring, then the spring isn't doing anything. So the restoring force is only gravity. So the oscillation frequency of this is the same as it was without the spring connected. So this is one of the normal modes. The other normal mode is like this. So I stretch the spring, and there's bigger restoring force, so the oscillation frequency is slightly higher. Okay? In quantum mechanics, the energy is given by the oscillation frequency. So the energy of this system is higher than the energy of the other system, if I set it for the same displacement. Okay, so those are the normal modes. If I put the system not into a normal mode, if I put it, say, into this mode, then all of the kinetic energy was in the yellow pendulum when it started, but the energy is being transferred to the red pendulum, and pretty soon the yellow one will stop, and then the energy will be transferred back from the red one back to the yellow one, and this will go on. Now, what has this got to do with quantum mechanics? This mode, where the energy is transferred back and forth between them, is not an eigenstate of this mechanical system. If you put it in an eigenstate, it would sit in the same state forever. This is a mixed state of the system. It turns out you can describe this system perfectly by a linear combination of this normal mode and the symmetric normal mode and the anti-symmetric normal mode. So this complicated-looking motion of this is actually just a simple linear superposition of the two normal modes. It's the same in quantum mechanics. The wave function can be in a superposition of the normal modes. The normal modes have this very simple time dependence. So the way that we can analyze the system easily is we figure out what the normal modes are, then we write down the starting state of the system in terms of the normal modes, and then we let the normal modes evolve in the normal way. Okay. So what has this all this got to do with quantum mechanics? Well, if I put this thing again in the superposition state, and now it's a quantum mechanical system, and now I'm going to measure the energy. Okay. So you can't see what I'm doing. But I measure the energy. So when I measure the energy, it went into that normal mode. So it has that energy, which is the lower energy. If I measure the energy again, so I put it back in this mixed mode, and I measure the energy again, then the system may jump into this mode, the anti-symmetric mode. So it has a different amount of energy. So the average energy that it had is half of this, is the mean of this energy and the other energy. So when you measure, the statistical energy stays the same, but the energy isn't conserved, because sometimes it goes to the higher energy state, this one, and other times it goes to the lower energy state, that one. Okay, so measurement changes the state of the system. So whatever this black box is here that you can't see inside of measures the energy. And if it measures the energy, it must measure either that energy, because that's one of the eigenenergies of the system, or it must measure this energy. So H bar times this frequency, or H bar times the other frequency. Now, if we express things in terms of the Hamiltonian, then the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian are the normal modes. And so that means that we'll be able to describe the entire evolution of the system just by a linear combination of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So this is the classical version. These are classical normal modes. Classical normal modes are exactly the things that turn into the quantum mechanical states, the quantum mechanical stationary states. Is it okay? The only hope you think is the measurement, which is just like quantum mechanics. You can't see what's happening inside the box. So the idea is we take the complicated problem, which has an infinite number of dimensions, and we resolve it into a finite number of components, or an infinite number of components, that we know the time evolution of. Now, there are two kinds of evolution. One is the smooth evolution given by the Hamiltonian. So if this is the state vector at some starting time, then what happens is that the Hamiltonian generates some motion of the state vector, so the state vector goes around in some smooth way. If you measure, then what happens is that the state vector has a discontinuous quantum jump onto one of the eigenvectors of the thing that you're measuring. So if you measure the energy, then it goes into an eigenstate of energy. If you measure the position, then it goes into an eigenstate of position. And if you measure the momentum, it goes into an eigenstate of momentum. Okay. So in the general case, if you have an operator that acts on a vector, it gives you another vector. And in general, the vector omega is not parallel to the vector v, as you saw in the first picture that I showed, where it changes its direction. But there's a special case where the operator omega, when it acts on one of its eigenvectors I, gives you back omega sub I, which is the corresponding eigenvalue, times the same eigenvector. Okay. These are the special states. These are the states that we want to know for the Hamiltonian. These are the states we call the stationary states. These are the states that correspond to the normal modes in a classical mechanics problem. Okay. So whenever this operator is Hermitian, then it turns out that all of its eigenvalues are real. So if omega were the x operator, then these would be the set of all of the x's in the problem, and they're all the real valued x's. Okay. It also turns out that whenever the operator is Hermitian, the set of all of its eigenvectors is the basis for the Hilbert space. Yeah? It always has a basis of eigenvectors, in fact. So saying there's a bunch of things that come with Hermitian. One thing is that its eigenvalues are real. Another thing is that if you look that the set of all of its eigenvectors form a basis for the whole space. So it's a little bit like symmetric. I mean, the analog for real matrices is that symmetric matrices share the same property. Maybe you were asking about a different...
Well, I think that answers my question, but I'm not sure like I understand the answer.
We're going to talk more about the answer. So if this were the Hamiltonian, then the set of its eigenvectors would go every direction in the space, so they would form a basis of the space. If this operator were the position operator, then the set of eigenvectors would be different. But again, you could write any vector in the abstract space as a linear combination of those vectors. If this operator were the momentum, and these would be the eigenstates of the momentum, then again, you could express any vector in terms of eigenstates of the momentum. But you can only do that if the operators are Hermitian, because if the operators aren't Hermitian, then their basis does not span the whole space. The Hamiltonian is the energy operator in quantum mechanics.
So the Hamiltonian is a Hermitian?
Yes, because you can measure the energy of the system, therefore the Hamiltonian has to be Hermitian.
Okay.
So if you're going to measure the position operator has to be Hermitian, and so on. So anything you can measure in a classical sense will correspond to an operator in quantum mechanics. And since you can measure all the classical quantities, that means that all those operators must be Hermitian. Yes?
So there would be an infinite number of eigenvectors which span the whole Hilbert space.
Yes, in general, yes.
Would there be any vectors left out? I mean, it seems like infinite vectors, but that still does not...
When we say basis, we mean that you can write down any vector. Sure, any linear combination of those vectors will not be necessarily an eigenvector.
So
it'll be a superposition of eigenvectors.
Okay, I guess that's a...
The other thing you're asking, is there some weird vector in the Hilbert space that I cannot create? The answer is no, because I have a basis that has an infinite number of dimensions, and I'm guaranteed that if I decompose the state vector into all of those directions, that it will be a complete description of any vector in the space. There are spaces where that's not true. They're not Hilbert spaces. Okay? We want a Hilbert space. I think there was a question over here. Yes?
But you answered it.
Really? No.
So every Hamiltonian is always Hermitian?
Yes. Yeah, and every X operator must be, every P operator must be, every operator that corresponds to anything you can measure. So there's a trivial case of the identity operator, so every vector is an eigenvector of the identity operator with eigenvalue 1, but that's not interesting. Okay, so now let's let's be more concrete about this and look at this with examples rather than completely abstractly. Here's a matrix, 3, 5, 2 on the diagonal. When the matrix is diagonal, we can read off the eigenvalues because the eigenvalues are the numbers on the diagonal. When the matrix is diagonal, we also know exactly what the eigenvectors are. So we know that one of the eigenvectors of this Hamiltonian or this operator is the vector 1, 0, 0, because when this acts on the vector 1, 0, 0, we get 3 times 1, 0, 0. Okay? So this is the eigenvalue, and this is the corresponding eigenvector. This is this second one, 0, 1, 0, is also an eigenvector of this operator. Its eigenvalue is 5. So when this operator acts on it, you get 5 times this vector. Okay. And this vector is also an eigenvector of that matrix, and its eigenvalue is minus 2. Now, you've seen this three-dimensional vector space many times, and you know that you can build any vector in the three-dimensional vector space by making linear combinations of these three things. Okay. That continues when you go into infinite-dimensional space as long as you're in a Hilbert space. There are other spaces that aren't complete, and in that case, that it doesn't happen.
Okay. So, in this example, that means that, that matrix, the diagonal matrix, would be a Hermitian operator. Is that correct?
It's Hermitian because it has real eigenvalues on the and it's in its diagonal form. So, with respect to this basis, it's diagonal. And we can also tell that it's Hermitian because if we look at its transpose conjugate is equal to it. Okay. So if we reflect it, if we interchange the rows and the columns and complex conjugate them, since everything here is real valued, then it also satisfies that test for Hermitian operator. When it's diagonal like this, it's easy to see that it's Hermitian. But I'm going to show you some other matrices that aren't diagonal where the test of the transpose conjugate being the same is an easier way to see what's going on.
Okay, so the only, the test of all real eigenvalues is enough to say it's a Hermitian?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So in this case, we have a unique set of eigenvalues, 3 and 5 and 2. There's no degeneracy there. So in that case, there's a unique basis, say this basis. And this is called the non-degenerate case. The non-degenerate case means that none of the eigenvalues is repeated. So what happens when we have a degenerate case? Okay, so here is a 3x3 matrix with degeneracy, 3, 2, 2. So for this matrix, we know that 1, 0, 0 is an eigenvector of this matrix, because this times 1, 0, 0 is 3 times 1, 0, 0, so that's an eigenvector. How about the next two? Well, for the next two, it turns out that there's no unique basis, because 0, 1, 0 is an eigenvector of this matrix with eigenvalue 2, but so is 0, 1, 1. And so is, and so there's a two. So when there's degeneracy, then there's a subspace. In this case, it's a two-dimensional subspace because it's two-dimensional. And any pair of vectors in that subspace will serve as a basis. Okay. So this is really important for the physics, because what we're going to want to find is a complete set of commuting observables, which people call a CSCO, because in general, the operators have degeneracy. So for the hydrogen atom, for example, it turns out that all of the states that are labeled by the principal quantum number n, that's the number 1, that's the number 1 in 1s, 2 in 2s, 3 in 3p, all of those states have the same energy. All states of a fixed n have the same energy. So if I only tell you this principal quantum number, you don't know what the state is yet, because that state could have different values of s. The values of s and p and d are labeled by this quantum number. So and these operators commute with each other. So if I tell you both n and l, then you know much more about what the state of the system is. But it still has another degree of freedom, which is m, the projection of the angular momentum onto the L axis. So in order to uniquely specify all of the states of the hydrogen atom, I have to give you these three quantum numbers. And that's because all three of these operators are degenerate. So no one by itself labels all the states. And in fact, no two by themselves label all of the states. You have to have all three of them in order to label all of the states. In classical mechanics, the way that you would solve, the way that you can solve most problems, if you're lucky, is you can find the conserved quantities. So the energy is conserved, the angular momentum is conserved, the z component of the angular momentum is conserved. And once you find those conserved quantities, then you can, then you have a solution to the problem. In quantum mechanics, the analog is you have to find a set of commuting observables. As soon as you find enough commuting observables to label all of the states uniquely, then you again have a solution to the problem. Okay, so conserved quantities in classical mechanics correspond to commuting observables in quantum mechanics. And we'll say a lot more about that.
Can you explain what you mean by labeling?
Right. So I have, let me think how to say this. I have hydrogen. It's in some state. Suppose it's in an eigenstate. If it's in an eigenstate, then it's in a particular level. So suppose it's in the n equal 3 level. It's in a particular angular momentum state. It can be in the 3s state or the 3p state or the 3d state. Okay. So this one is the 3, the principal quantum number. This one is spdf, depending on what the value of this is. But then if it's in one of those states, say if it's in the P states, there are three P states. There's a PX state, a PY state, and a PZ state. Okay. So if I want to tell you the hydrogen atom is in this state, then I have to tell you enough information so that you know this unique state that it's in. Okay. And these three numbers turn out to be a complete set of states for the hydrogen atom, which is the last thing we're going to talk about in this class. And they correspond to these three operators. And if you have planetary operator, if you have planetary orbits, the energy, the angular momentum, and the z component of the angular momentum are all conserved. So this is analogous to what you do in the three-dimensional classical mechanics problem.
So you're saying that in classical mechanics, if you had any one of those observables known, then would you be able to know the exact state of the, say, like satellite, moon, whatever it is in?
Right. So if I tell you only the energy, you don't know what the orbit is because there are an infinite number of orbits with that energy. Because there, you can make elongated orbits that have the same energy as a round orbit.
Okay.
So just telling the total energy does not specify it. Telling the total angular momentum still does not specify it because it doesn't tell you which direction the rotation is around. Telling you the z component of the angular momentum gives you enough variables that you have everything pinned down. So. How do you tell whether operators commute with the Hamiltonian? Whether the operators are the ones that you want. So you want operators that commute with the Hamiltonian. And so let me tell you about the commutator, the commutation relations. So the commutator of two operators, A and B, is equal to operator A times operator B minus operator B times operator A. If those operators, are simultaneously diagonalizable, then this will be zero. But the matrices in general depend on the order in which you multiply them. Okay. So if you have two matrices. Which when you calculate this thing, so this is an operator. This operator says there's a vector over here. It says act first with matrix A, then act with matrix B, and compare that to what you get by acting first with matrix B and then with matrix A. Okay. If the two operators are both diagonal, then it's clear that you get zero. If they're not diagonal, then if they can be simultaneously diagonalized, then it still works. If they can't be simultaneously diagonalized, then they do not share a common eigenbasis. So the L-squared operator commutes with the Hamiltonian, and the L-squared operator commutes with the z-component of the angular momentum, and the z-component of the angular momentum commutes with the energy. So all three of these operators commute with each other. And in addition, they label all of the states, so they are a complete set of commuting observables. So if the commutator is zero, then you know that you can diagonalize them simultaneously. That is, there is a basis in which they're both diagonal. Then again, just to say this again, in classical mechanics you'd find all the conserved quantities. In quantum mechanics, you find a complete set of commuting observables. Okay. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. What I'm going to tell you is the same way that you would diagonalize any other operator, but the Hamiltonian plays a very special role in quantum mechanics. Okay. So let me remind you or tell you how you find the eigenvectors and the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors of an operator omega. So you write down, you take the determinant of the operator minus its eigenvalue omega times the identity operator, and you set that equal to zero. So that gives you this thing called the characteristic equation, which is a polynomial. If there are three components in the operator, then it's a polynomial that has x cubed and x squared and x. Then you solve this characteristic equation to find out the set of the eigenvalues. So that will give you a set of little omega sub i's. Remember, Shankar's convention is that the operator is a capital Greek letter, and the eigenvalues of the operator are represented by the lowercase Greek letter. So when you've done this, then it will be true that the operator, capital omega, acting on one of its eigenstates, this eigenket omega sub I, will be equal to the number omega sub I times the eigenket that corresponds to omega sub I. This is exactly the same way that you solve a normal modes problem. For a normal modes problem, you also write down a determinant. You also solve its characteristic equation. And what comes out of it are the normal mode frequencies that you would get.
So is an eigenket just the eigenvector corresponding to that specific?
Exactly. It's the generic thing in the Hilbert space. And then if I put it in a basis, it will be the wave function in X. Or if I put it in the P basis, it'll be the wave function of P. So writing it this way, where there are no coordinates anywhere, tells you this is in the Hilbert space. I haven't chosen a basis yet. But as soon as I go to, say, the position basis, then this will be the wave function of this operator. So it'll be the wave function as a function of X. It's just an index that labels the state vector. And so it says I am the ket that when big omega operates on me, I give you back little omega sub I. So when things are not degenerate, then this specifies everything. When things are degenerate, there'll be two or more of them that have the same omega sub I. So I mentioned in this class that we're going to talk about problems where the Hamiltonian is not a function of time. That means energy is conserved. You probably know that it's much harder to solve the planetary orbit problem if you put in friction, if you put in the fact that the planets are slowing down so the Earth is slowing down on its spin axis. It's also slowing down in its trajectory. Because it's radiating gravitational waves, if nothing else. So in this case where energy is conserved, then the Hamiltonian generates the time evolution, and then what you want to do is you want to decompose the problem into eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. It turns out because the Hamiltonian plays the same role, even in a situation where the energy does depend on time, it still plays a very special role. But as I mentioned, I'm not going to tell you about... I'm not planning to tell you about the few cases where the energy depends on time that you can actually solve. It's really hard to put friction into quantum mechanics. Okay, so here is the next example. Here is an operator that has this strange matrix representation: 101, 020, 101. What are its eigenvectors? What are its eigenvalues? Don't jump out at you. They're not obvious what they are, unless you've seen this matrix before. Turns out this matrix... Do you ever wonder how instructors always get matrices that work out so neatly? Do you think they stay awake late at night figuring out what those operators are? No, they already studied some other problem where you have to know those operators. So they pretend like they don't know the answer, and then they work out the answer. Okay, so after the break, we'll work out the answer to this problem the old-fashioned way, and then I'll tell you about the newfangled way as well. So why don't we start again at 8:05? Questions are fine. Yes, sir?
It seems like I'm not receiving your emails.
Oh, send me your email address. Yeah, and I'm sorry. I thought I had everybody on the list. And every time I send a list, I say, please let me know if you're not receiving these emails. And but it only works if somebody, you know, if somebody else passes to them that email message. But it has gotten a couple of people that to do it, actually. Because some friend would say, did you read that email? And they'll say, what email? Right. So in the this problem that we had back here.
Yeah, I didn't get the subspace part.
Right. There's a two-dimensional subspace, but there are lots of different basis vectors for that subspace. For example, this is a good set of basis vectors for that subspace, right? It corresponds to one set of coordinate axes. But if I rotate them by 45 degrees, that's another coordinate axis, okay? Or if I rotate it by any angle, that's still a perfectly good set of coordinates. So that means that the basis, that the total basis is not completely determined. In the subspace, I can have any linear combination of some vectors.
What's that got to do with the two eigenvalues being the same?
So it's the reason why you get a degenerate subspace in energy or in whatever, because, how to say it, because you don't have unique eigenvectors. The reason this is important is, suppose you measure and you get two. Then where's the state vector? Is it along this direction or is it along that direction? And that has to be independent of the coordinates. So it's in a specific direction, but its components are coordinate dependent. So I could say it has this projection along or that projection along the other axis, or I could turn the axes and say, no, you're wrong. It has this projection along this axis and that projection along that axis. But it has one specific vector. And that vector is what you get now by projecting the state vector not onto the axes, but into the subspace.
So does that mean that if you do a measurement like this, the system jumps to a particular, does not really jump to a particular state, it jumps to a subspace of the state?
No, it jumps to a particular state in the subspace. It has gone to one unique state, but you don't know.
You don't know which one.
You don't know how to write that state down in a basis.
So, I guess if you try to make the analogy with the points on a line, so if you have these infinite positions where it could have been, and you make a measurement, usually it goes to one place there. But this time, it won't go to one place. It will go to a subspace of all of these. And you can't uniquely say yet which one of these.
Well, it can only go to more than one point if there's more than one point that has the same energy. So in position space, it's not something that comes up very often. An easy example is momentum space. In momentum space, a fixed value of momentum corresponds to traveling this way and corresponds to traveling that way. So they're degenerate. So if I tell you the energy of the particle, then you know that p squared over 2m has to be equal to that, but you don't know whether p is positive or negative yet. But when you measure p, then it goes to one of them or the other one.
And if you measured p, you wouldn't know.
After you measure p, you do know. You do know, yeah. But if you only measure e, you don't know. Exactly. Yes?
So I can't explain why this is important to me, but it is. So I'm trying to figure out how sort of the math for quantum mechanics reduces to classical physics. So like if I had the relativistic equations, I could just say, well, B is much smaller than C, and so all these terms are close to zero, and everything drops out, and we get to those equations again.
Right.
So you said something earlier that was something like the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian correspond to the results from classical mechanics. So is the difference then the probability waveform into those equations? If I sort of took that out, would I just get classical mechanics?
It turns out there's a single parameter way to think about it, which is the same as letting the speed of light go to infinity instead of being finite. And that is the number that specifies how quantum mechanical you are is Planck's constant, h or h bar. So as h bar goes to zero, you have classical mechanics.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
the time for one more question?
Mm-hmm. Three more questions. There's 3 minutes. This is a very long question.
So we had the eigenvalues. If the eigenvalue happens to be 1,
okay,
does that imply that can this only happen for the identity operator, or can there be non-identity operators where the eigenvalue is 1?
There are lots of operators where the eigenvalue is 1. They're not the identity operator. Okay, so here is the matrix. Can we diagonalize that matrix? One way to find out is to do it. But there's an easier way to find out, which is to ask the question, if I interchange the rows and the columns, if I transpose this, then complex conjugated, does it look the same? And it does look the same, so that means that this is a representation of a Hermitian matrix, and I will be able to diagonalize it. If I took away one of these numbers, like if I took away that one right there, then it would not be Hermitian matrix, and then I would not be guaranteed that I can diagonalize it, nor would I be guaranteed that its eigenvalues are real. So it's a very simple test to see whether one of these operators is Hermitian before you go to all the trouble to diagonalize it. Any one of them. If I took any one of these ones away, then its rows and columns, when I interchange them, would not be the same. Right? They're real numbers, so the complex conjugation doesn't do anything.
Not for the ones on the diagonal. When you transpose the, they're on the diagonal, it wouldn't matter.
Sorry, bad example. Let's put some numbers over here. Yeah. Take away 2 of them. Yeah, good point. Okay. So let's write down the characteristic equation for this. So I subtract lambda from the diagonal, omega from the diagonal. So I get 1 minus omega, 2 minus omega, and 1 minus omega. Right? I just subtract omega times the identity operator, so that subtracts omega from this one, and this one. And now I have to calculate the determinant of that. And that's going to make a polynomial. It's going to make a polynomial in omega cubed. And then I have to find the roots of that polynomial. Okay, so the polynomial I get is called the characteristic equation. So here's the characteristic equation. So if I expand around this corner, right, so then I cross out these two, and I multiply 1 minus omega times 2 minus omega times 1. cross out these two. 2 minus omega times 1 minus omega minus 0 times 0. So that gives me this term. Then I have to expand it around another point. So I expand it around this point, and I get this. Then I expand it around this point, and I get that. Okay. So I end up with with an equation that this equation, it turns out that there's a quadratic and there's a monadic. So I know what one of the eigenvalues is right away because I can factor this thing because it's already partially factored. Okay. Or I can multiply it all out and collect all the terms, and I'll find that I have the equation omega cubed plus 4 omega squared minus 4 omega is equal to 0. And I can factor omega out of all of those. And so I know that one of the solutions is omega equals 0. So this is the characteristic equation. Factor it. I get omega times omega minus 2 times omega minus 2. So that tells me that the eigenvalues are 0, 2, and 2. Now, what are the eigenvectors that correspond to those eigenvalues? Well, the first one is easy. The first one, let's take a general vector, A, B, C, and we want to find values of A, B, and C such that when this matrix operates on it, we get back the eigenvalue times A, B, C. For the zero eigenvalue, that means that when this matrix acts on this vector, we want to get back zero. So that tells us when we take this row and multiply it times the vector, we get A plus C. We take this row and multiply it by the vector, we get 2 times B. We take this row and multiply it by the vector, we get A plus C. So now we have this set of algebraic equations that we want to solve, so we have to find values of A, B, and C that where A plus C adds up to 0 and A plus C adds up to 0 and 2B adds up to 0. So we can choose B equal to 0, and we can choose C equal minus A. So then we would be saying that the eigenket that corresponds to omega equals 0 is represented by A times 1, 0, minus 1, where A is a normalization constant. This is an eigenvector. We would like it so the dot product of this eigenvector with itself is 1. Okay. So if you dot this into itself, you get 1 times 1, and you get minus 1 times minus 1, so you get 2. So we know that that A squared has to be equal to A squared times 2 has to be equal to 1, so A has to be equal 1 over root 2. Okay, so here I'm going to normalize it. So take the inner product of the omega equals 0, ket with the omega equals 0 bra. So here is the omega sub 0 representation of the omega sub 0 ket. It's the normalization factor times 1, 0, minus 1. To get the corresponding bra, I transpose it and then I conjugate everything. So when I transpose it and conjugate, I get A star. And then I get 1, 0, minus 1 star. But since everything is real, it doesn't change. So then if I go ahead and take this times this, I get A times A star times 2 is equal to 1, which means that 2 times A star is equal to 1. And now we have a convention, which is we choose the real positive value. I mean, minus 1 over square root of 2 is a root of this equation, as is I over the square root of 2. There are an infinite number of choices of A that satisfy this equation. They're all values of A that sit on a unit circle of radius 1/2. Okay, so just by convention, choose the positive real one. So then we have that the eigenket corresponding to eigenvalue omega equals 0 is equal to 1 over root 2 times 1, 0, minus 1. This is the normalized eigenket. Okay. Now, this one was unique. There was only one eigenvalue equal to 0, so we got a unique eigenvector out of it. The next two, there are two eigenkets that have omega equal 2. Okay. So how do we do them? It's the same business. Now we have our matrix times our generic vector ABC has to be equal to 2 times ABC. So we go ahead and do the matrix multiplication. And we find that A plus C has to be equal to 2 times A. And 2 times B has to be 2 times B, and A plus C has to be equal to 2 plus C. Okay. So now we have to solve this. That is, we have to find values of A, B, and C that satisfy these equations. So Notice that this term says that A plus C has to be equal to 2A, and this term says that A plus C has to be equal to 2C. So that tells us that 2A has to equal 2C, so that tells us that A has to equal C. So let's choose 1 for A and C. We'll have to normalize it after that. So 1, 0, 1 is an eigenvector of this matrix with eigenvalue 2. The other condition tells us that 2B has to be equal to 2B. That means we can choose anything for B. So if you can choose anything, what would you choose?
Zero.
Yeah. So, but this is not a unique solution to this problem, because I could have chosen anything. I could have chosen lots of other things for B. Okay.
So if B was only one value, but you're still choosing the A equals C arbitrarily, that does not result in multiple eigenvalues.
A equals C is not a choice. It comes out of here. It comes out of A plus C has to be equal to 2C, and A plus C has to be equal to 2A. So we know they must be equal. Setting them equal to 1 is a
choice.
No, because if we set them equal to any other number, as soon as we normalize them, they'd come out to be the same. I mean, this vector is an eigenvector. Vector twice that long is an eigenvector. 3 times that long is an eigenvector. So, yeah, so any choice of A and C only corresponds to changing the length of the vector. And then as soon as you normalize it, you'll be back to...
That was true for the eigenvalue 0 also.
Yes. Okay. So in this case, there's no unique solution because those two eigenvalues are degenerate. So there are infinite many different choices of the eigenvectors. So of this form, okay. So we can choose one arbitrarily. So let's choose the one where b is equal to 0. Then when we normalize this vector, we have 1 over root 2. So this is a normalized eigenvector of that matrix with eigenvalue 2. How do we find the next one? Well, the next one, we want to have an orthonormal set, basis set. So in order for the basis set to be orthonormal, that we can just construct a vector which is perpendicular to this one and perpendicular to the first one. So that means that we want this vector, ABA, dotted into this vector, 1, 0, 1, So we can choose 0, 1, 0 as the other eigenvector with eigenvalue 2.
How did you get that?
This says that, right? This thing has to be equal to 0. That's what orthogonal means. So that means that A times 1 has to be equal to 0, and B times 0 has to be equal to 0. And this one doesn't add anything. It also says A times 1 has to be equal to 0. Okay, so we're forced to choose 0 here and 0 here, and we can put any number we want in here except 0. The eigenvalues can be 0, but we don't want to have 0 eigenvectors because then they don't specify a direction in space. Is that okay?
So one change was a little bit back, we called B equals 0. When we got down here, we decided not to use B equals 0 or B equals 0.
Well, I said B equal to 0 up here. Now, this is a new set of equations. I should have put, you know, C and D or something in them rather than A and B.
So that vector you want to be perpendicular to the vector you found
before. Yeah. Right. I could choose an arbitrary one, but then I'd have to Gram-Schmidt in order to make them be orthogonal. So since there are only two of them, it's easy to make the second one perpendicular to the first. At my age? I think the question is, could you Gram-Schmidt that and get a correct answer? And the answer to that question is yes.
I guess my question comes from the fact that as a result of Gram-Schmidt, you don't get a unique set of bases.
You would here because, see, the first one was chosen, and all you're doing is getting the second one.
Oh, okay, so the process assuming that you will not change the first
one. Right. Well, here there are only two, so yes, Gram-Schmidt would work for this. But, yeah, in general... You'll get an arbitrary subbasis because you can pick any one as your first one, right? And then,
okay.
Yep. Okay, so this is a really important step when you're doing this by hand, which is to check your answer. Checking your answer is trivial compared to calculating your answer. So is this matrix times that vector equal to zero? Yep. So that means we've got the right eigenvector for the zero eigenvalue. Is this matrix times that vector equal to 2 times that vector? Yes. So we got the right. So this is an eigenvector of that matrix with eigenvalue 2, as is its normalized version. And the third one is this matrix times that vector equal to 2 times that vector, and it is. So then we have a sigh of relief. And then we say, what in the world? What's wrong with these physics instructors? They're teaching us how to do stuff like it's 1960 or maybe 1970 when we don't have a computer algebra system on our computer or there's no internet, so we can't just solve such a stupid problem with a few keystrokes. And I agree with that. You don't have to solve any eigenvalue, eigenvector problems in this class. You have to solve some on the exam, but you can use a computer to do it. That's fine with me. So here are three computers that are good. this one does complex entries up to 32 by 32. Okay, so that's pretty big. Okay, so 1, 0, 1, then we have 0, 2, 0, then we have 1, 0, 1, and let's find out what the eigenvalues and eigenvectors are for that familiar-looking matrix. So the eigenvalues are 2 and 0 and 2. That sounds familiar. And the eigenvectors are 1 over root 2, 0, 1 over root 2, and minus 1 over root 2, 0, 1 over root 2, which is minus the one that we had, but minus the one that we had is still a perfectly good choice. So that is one of these. How about this matrix? Zero I minus I zero. Is it Hermitian matrix? Yes, because if we transpose, if we interchange the rows and columns and we complex conjugate it. So what do you think? It's Hermitian matrix, so it has to have 2 eigenvalues and 2 eigenvectors, and those 2 eigenvectors have to span the space. Okay, so let's see what we get. So sometimes this guy has trouble, and it has trouble. It gets the wrong answer there, clearly. So undeterred, we simply go to another. So if you checked that by hand, you would find that it's wrong.
Actually, you got the question wrong.
Did I put it in wrong?
Yeah.
Oh, I did.
It's in the spaces in those numbers, because the negative sign makes it all aligned.
You want to... You want to give him another chance? So you want me to put in 0 space I. So I did that. Then you want me to put in minus I space 0. So I did that also. I believe you that it's something about the separation, but...
That's what you did last time. Yeah,
this is exactly what I did last time. So what do you want me to do? Put another space in here? Okay. See, again, it gets the, it says the input matrix is 0. So, sorry, I 0 minus I 0. I did a whole bunch of things wrong. Thank you. So let's see if this one does any better. So it says that the characteristic polynomial is x squared minus 1, and that means that there are 2 eigenvalues. One of them is plus 1, and one of them is minus 1. And the eigenvector that corresponds to eigenvalue minus 1 is minus I1. And the eigenvector that corresponds to eigenvalue 1 is I1. Okay. Those aren't normalized. If I normalize them, I put a 1 over root 2 out in front of them. Okay. So if you're old and tired, then you know that this operator is the SY operator. Yeah. And you know what the eigenvalues are of the XY operator, so you know the answer to this question before you do anything. But that's another story. Okay. So the question is, maybe I'll keep going and then come back to some of these applets at the end. Well, we can talk about a couple of things right now. What's the fundamental theorem of algebra? Any polynomial with complex coefficients has polynomial of degree n with complex coefficients has n roots. It took a long time to prove it. It wasn't proved until the 1700s. Greeks didn't know that. What's the Abel-Ruffini theorem? Oh, of course. It's the one that says that there's no closed-form solution for polynomial equations of degree bigger than 4. So you know the quadratic equation. There's a specific thing you can write down with radicals in it, in that case square roots in it, that gives you the answer to any quadratic equation. There's also one for cubic equations. There's also one from quartic equations, but there's no closed form solution using only radicals for all fifth order equations. That was a big deal. But now, just try 2 or 3 applets on the internet, and if 2 of them agree, then you'll know the answer. Maybe. Okay, so let's keep going with this same problem. Okay. So we just found that this matrix, 1, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 1, 0, 1, has an eigenvector 1 over root 2 times 1, 0, minus 1, and that eigenvalue is 0. It has an eigenvector 1, 0, 1, 1 over root 2 to normalize it, and that eigenvalue is 2. And then it has another eigenvector 0, 1, 0, also with eigenvalue equal to 2. Okay? These three vectors form an orthonormal basis. That is to say, I can take A times this plus B times this. No, I can take alpha times this plus beta times this plus gamma times this, and that will give me any vector in the three-dimensional space. Right? If I dot this into this, I get 0. If I dot this into this, I get 0. If I dot that into that, I get 0. Okay. So it's orthonormal, meaning ortho means that they're all perpendicular to each other, and normal means that they all have length 1. Okay. So I have a set of the set of eigenvectors for this Hermitian operator form a basis for three-dimensional space. So basis means I can make any vector in the space. In this case, it's a three-dimensional space. Normal means that the dot product of the vector with itself is 1, and orthogonal means that they're all perpendicular to each other. Okay, so actually, I'm not going to make you change bases, but I guess I can still tell you this. you have one set of basis vectors, and the vectors have specific components. If I change the set of basis vectors, then the vectors will have a different set of components. They'll be exactly the same geometrical object. They'll just have projections onto the three new directions that'll be different than the projections onto the three original directions. So there's a way to change ket in one basis into what the ket will be in another basis. And the way that you change it is you multiply it times a unitary operator. There's also a way to change an operator from one basis to another basis. This is wrong. This should be a dagger. U dagger, sorry. So this unitary matrix is built out of the orthonormal basis vectors. its orthonormal basis vectors. Okay, so it works like this. We found that one of the eigenvectors that had eigenvalue 2 was 0, 1, 0. So put that into this column. We found another one that had omega equal 2 is 1, 0, 1. So put that into this column with the normalization factor in it. And we found the third one is 1, 0, minus 1, 1 over root 2. So put that into the third column. This is just a convention that you put in the highest eigenvalue over here and the lowest eigenvalue over here. In this case, you could have interchanged these two. In fact, you can put these in any order that you like, and this is going to work. It's just a question of, do you want to have, what do you want the answer to be, 2, 0, 2, or 2, 2, 0, or 0, 2, 2? So it just changes how we're going to map things, how the diagonal matrix will look. Okay, so this one, since I put in the two highest eigenvalues, this, when I diagonalize this matrix, there's going to be 2, 2, 0. So why does it work? It works because there's a theorem that says the eigenvalues of any Hermitian operator are real, and it also says that any Hermitian operator has at least one set of orthonormal eigenvectors that are basis for the space. And in this basis, the operator is diagonal with its eigenvalues on the diagonal. Okay? So those theorems guarantee that this will work. Okay? But that's just theorems. How does it work? Well, it works like this. This inner product, the inner product of the W bra with the V ket, is a number. It has the same value in any coordinate system you like. What it looks like in different coordinate systems is different, okay? But it's a geometric thing. It says take the length of one vector, take the length of the other vector, take the cosine of the angle between them, and that's the dot product. So it does not depend on a coordinate system. So that means if we take this inner product and we change the basis to the W prime V prime basis, we want to get the same answer that we got here. Okay? So one way we can guarantee that is that we can put the identity operator in between the W bra and the V ket. And there are a bunch of ways to write the identity operator. Later, we'll use this trick again and again and again. Right now, though, we're going to use the fact that the identity operator is a unitary operator U times U dagger. This thing, U dagger times V, is a new vector. Call it V prime. This thing, U operator acting to its left on the W bra, is a new bra, call it W prime. This works because U dagger is the identity operator. So this is a proof, if you like, of the fact that the operators that you need to transform the ket, that you need to multiply kets times U dagger, and the operator that you need to transform bras is you have to left multiply by U. Now, for operators, you do exactly the same thing. So this thing is a number. That means that it has to be the same in any basis. So now you put the identity in twice. You get back the thing we used before, which is you get U dagger times V. And we know that we called that V prime already. And if you split this part off, you get U times W bra, which we called W prime before. And that leaves you with U dagger omega U. And that has to be the transformed operator omega prime. Okay. How does it work? Well, remember what we did was we said that the unitary operator U, you lay the eigenvectors into the columns. So when you transpose this and conjugate it to calculate U dagger, then the E1 eigenvector complex conjugate is this way, the E2 eigenvector complex conjugate is that way, and the E3 eigenvector complex conjugate is that way. So now it's obvious what happens, which is that when this matrix acts on this vector, this dotted into that is 1. So there's a 1 here. And this dotted into that is 0, and this dotted into that is 0, because these are orthogonal. And similarly, if you take this matrix and you act on eigenvector 2, then eigenvector 2 dotted into eigenvector 1 is 0. Only this one gives you a 1. And only that one gives you a 1. So U-dagger changes the ket basis, and U changes the bra basis. And if you want to change an operator, you have to act on it on both sides, on one side with U-dagger and on the other side with U. Okay, so does this work? Let's take our let's take this matrix that used to be our favorite matrix, but we're getting kind of tired of it now. And let's left and right multiply it times this unitary matrix. Okay, so if we do this matrix operation, we get this. And if we do this matrix operation, we get this. And if we put the half inside, then we get the diagonal form of that operator, which is 2, 2, 0. So, yes, it works. This is the first step in solving every quantum mechanics problem that you're going to solve. First thing you have to do is find the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. We also call that diagonalize the Hamiltonian, because if you get the Hamiltonian in this form, then it's obvious what the eigenvalues are and it's obvious what the associated eigenvectors are. So if you want to solve all of the world's problems, all you have to do is diagonalize the universe. Presumably in that diagonalization, people would come out, stars would come out, alien, intelligent aliens would come out, everything would come out. So then there's a theorem, theorem 13 in Shankar, that says if the operator capital omega and the operator capital lambda are commuting Hermitian operators, then there exists a common basis of eigenvalues that diagonalizes them both. Okay. And the easy test for that is to calculate the commutator. So calculate the omega matrix, the lambda matrix times omega matrix, and take that away from the omega matrix times the lambda matrix. Okay. If they're diagonal, then it's clearly going to work. But this thing has three cases. One case is the operators are compatible, which means they share all of their eigenvectors. So if this coefficient is zero, then they're completely compatible, and there is a basis in which they have exactly the same eigenvectors. One is a case where they're completely incompatible, which means that they don't share any eigenvectors. And there's a third case where they're mixed, where they share some eigenvectors but not all eigenvectors. Yes?
Is the concept of compatibility for two operators similar to the concept of orthogonality for two markers?
No, it's similar to the concept of parallelism of two vectors, I would say.
Okay.
Which is to say they're, you know, they're... yeah. So here are two operators. they're diagonal operators, so it's easy to read off the eigenvalues, and it's we know by inspection what the associated eigenvectors are. So if these commute, then there'll be a simultaneous basis. It's pretty clear there's going to be a simultaneous basis here. If you take... if you multiply the omega matrix times the lambda matrix, then you get the product of the diagonals this way. And if you multiply the lambda matrix times the omega matrix, then you get the product of the diagonals in the opposite order. Okay, but clearly this is equal to that, so when you take their difference, you get zero. Then this again just tries to reiterate this point that... what we're looking for in quantum mechanics are all the conserved quantities, which the analog of the conserved quantities in classical mechanics, which means we want to find all the operators that commute with the Hamiltonian. We don't have to find all of them. All we have to find is enough of them so that they completely specify everything. There are cases where there are multiple choices of the complete set of commuting observables. Okay. So... I've talked a little bit already about this. When you take a bra and a ket and you put them together to make a bracket, that's the analog of an inner product. And I've talked a little bit about the fact that in quantum mechanics, we write down our vectors as kets and bras. There are no arrows inside of kets and bras, and there aren't bold letters inside of kets and bras. So our ways of writing things down in normal n dimensions, where we put a vector over it, or we put them in bold typeface, or we put them in blackboard bold, we don't do that, that the typesetters like that. When you add them, this is symbolically how you add them. When you subtract them, this is symbolically how you subtract them. When you multiply them times a scalar, this is symbolically how you write that. When you take the dot product, V dot W, here we take the inner product, V bra omega ket. In general, this is a complex number. But if you take WW, it's not a complex number because that's the length of the W vector. And if you take V times V, that also has to be a real number. And that's the reason why we have this rule about complex conjugating the bra, because that will guarantee that we always get a real number. Okay. And this thing is the length. It's the metric. It tells us how long a vector is. If you study general relativity, you ran into a similar thing, which is there are covariant and contravariant vectors, which are also elements of a dual space, which also have a rule like this. But that rule has a metric tensor in it, not complex conjugation. But here we have complex conjugation. Then we also have an outer product, which we write as ket and bra, and that turns out to be a matrix operator. Now, what do I want to tell you about all this stuff? When you add, so if you write down a vector and a basis, then you know that you just add the components. It's the same. In Dirac notation. You take the inner product between two of them, then you take one of them, and you form its transpose conjugate, so you get a row vector times the column vector, and you end up with alpha 1 star times beta 1 plus alpha 2 star times beta 2. So component by component. Okay. So this thing, this ket, is something that lives in this ket space, and it's an abstract vector. If we go into a basis, then it has a representation in a specific basis. Okay? But that's basis dependent. Okay? Over here, it's the ket exists in ket space all by itself. Okay? Likewise, this bra exists in bra space all by itself. It's a vector in the bra space that doesn't need any stinking coordinates. But if you want to choose a coordinate system and you choose the same coordinate system as that, then it's the transpose conjugate of the ket. Okay? So this row vector, column vector makes it so that the bra ket, the bracket, is a number. Okay, so now this is what I wanted to say about the two spaces. They're isomorphic dual spaces. That means that this one is exactly like that one. Okay. But over here, this is the space where kets live, and over here, this is the space where bras live. Okay. So there are no kets over here and there are no bras over there. These two spaces have exactly the same geometry, which means they have exactly the same algebra. I already told you about Dirac's pun and how embarrassed he was, so we won't embarrass him anymore. Sorry. Oh, no, it's missing. Well, let me go past page 33. Okay, so this is what I wanted to talk about. So these spaces are exactly the same. There's a transformation between them, which is the adjoint operator. So if I take this bra and I calculate its adjoint, then I get the corresponding ket, and vice versa. So this transformation between the two spaces is the adjoint operation. And what does it do? Well, if you have a scalar, it transposes it, but transposes it the same, and then it calculates its complex conjugate. If you have a ket, then the adjoint turns it into the corresponding bra. If you have a bra, then the adjoint turns it into the corresponding ket. If you have an operator, then the operator is turned into the operator dagger, the transpose conjugate operator, if you go through the adjoint operation. Okay? Now, we want everything to work so that everything's exactly the same, which means that if operator O takes ket V into ket V prime, then we want operator O dagger to take bra V into bra V prime. So in ket space, V prime is equal to the operator acting on V. So in ket space, operators act to their right. In bra space, the operator dagger acting to the left on the bra V is equal to the bra V prime. Okay? So in bra space, operators act to the left to act on bra space. And there's a bunch of stuff we don't need. Okay, so here's an analogy between numbers and operators. You know that if you want to find you know that complex conjugation, what happens is a number alpha, which is a plus bi, you change the sign of the imaginary part, okay? And you know that if you want to find out the real part of alpha, then you can just take 1/2 times alpha plus alpha star, because the imaginary part falls out. If you want to know the imaginary part of alpha, you can take 1/2 of alpha minus alpha star. You can do the same thing with operators. Any operator, capital omega, can be decomposed into a Hermitian piece plus an anti-Hermitian piece. And if you want to know them, you take the Hermitian, you do exactly the same thing. So the Hermitian operator piece of it corresponds to 1/2 of the sum of the operator and its adjoint, and the anti-Hermitian operator corresponds to 1/2 of the operator minus its adjoint. So that means Hermitian operators are like complex numbers, are like the real part of complex numbers, and anti-Hermitian operators are like the imaginary part of complex numbers. And we want the real part because we're using operators that correspond to measurements, so we need the real eigenvalues. Okay. We also have numbers that live on the unit circle, and so the numbers beta live on the unit circle, and you can parameterize them by e to the I phi. In the same way, we have the unitary operator leaves the length of things unchanged, and it turns out that unitary operators have e to the I phi, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, down the diagonal. Okay, and I don't know why it goes back to there, but that's it for today. Next time, we'll continue boldly onward, and we'll also open some new frontiers. So probably we'll start postulates.
Yes, sir. So outer product gives you a matrix rather
yes.
than a scalar?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so the column vector, row vector, then it turns into a matrix.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right on. Oh, I wanted to make an announcement. I'll come right back to your question. Don't do the second quantitative problem on the exam. And has anybody finished the exam? Has anybody looked at the exam? You almost finished it? So if you've almost finished it, you can give it to me, and I'll give you full credit for having done too much work. But I want to change the first problem to make it a little bit more straightforward. And the second problem had no pedagogy.
Okay.
And the question was? Right, so I'm going to talk about the Fourier transformations when we do continuous problems.
Okay.
So math unit 4 was about continuous things rather than discrete things, and I'm going to take that material and put it into when we're actually doing continuous systems. Right, so it turns out that Fourier transforms are just a change of basis. Between the X space and the P space, or the X space and the K space, yeah, and I will talk about that because that's pretty important for a lot of stuff in this class.
Analogy between the complex numbers and the complex field, complex vectors, I guess.